From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, a unity rally for the Republicans results in disunion by the Schuette campaign.
Snubbing Cali was just a dumb thing to do.
A big dairy processing plant could solve Michigan's milk glut in the future.
Hopefully, they can be taking milk in 18 months to 2 years.
A Muslim filmmaker spends time with neo-Nazis from Michigan to understand racism and bigotry.
When I was growing up, I was always told, look, you just need to give this time, and eventually this problem will disappear.
And one of Detroit's famous architects helped make it possible for the USSR to beat Germany during World War II.
He builds the lion's share, well over half, of the industrial capacity that would end up enabling the Soviets to defeat the Nazis.
Those stories plus our political commentators on the primary elections. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Attorney General Bill Schuette won the four-way race to become the gubernatorial candidate for the Republicans. There was a unity rally in Grand Rapids. The idea was to bring the party together after a fairly fractious primary race. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, the leading opponent in the primary race, showed up to offer his endorsement of Schuette. Schuette's team declined his offer. Joining me to talk about that and another Republican snub is Nolan Finley, the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. What did you think of Schuette's campaign turning Kelly away?
Well, yeah, I don't think that was the best way to start a campaign. Kelly got a good measure of support in that primary. I mean, it wasn't a close race, but it's still a significant number. Bill Schuette's going to need every single Republican vote he can get to win this election. He's not going to steal away any Democratic votes. He's got to keep all the Republicans home and get the independents. Snubbing Kelly was just a dumb thing to do.
So why does it seem there's so much bad blood between Kelly and Schuette?
Well, they run a very bitter campaign. Schuette's camp believes that Kelly cheap-shotted them, but the cheap shots were going on both ways. I wrote a column early on in this campaign, suggested they both cut it off lest they damage the party in the primary, and well, here we are.
Yeah, I recall that.
In the general election, I mean.
Yeah.
Here we are.
I recall that editorial, and it doesn't seem like they listened to you this time, Nolan.
No, well, I'm getting used to that.
The other issue is Governor Rick Snyder's decision not to endorse Schuette. This is what he had to say about that.
At this point in time, I'm staying focused on governing and more governing and less politics at this point in time.
So give us a little background about the relationship between Bill Schuette and Rick Snyder.
That's all about these Flint prosecutions. The governor believes he was being tried by proxy by the attorney general to benefit the attorney general's run for governor. And he felt these trials right along were politically motivated. These prosecutions were designed to distance Schuette from the Snyder administration, and he didn't appreciate it. I would be surprised if at this time turns into never.
How common is it for a sitting governor not to endorse his own party's candidate for the office?
I understand that Bill Milliken didn't endorse Richard Hedley way back when Hedley ran against Blanchard at the end of the Milliken term. I may not be right about that, but that's my understanding. I understand there was bad blood between those two as well.
You know, Will Rogers is famous for saying, I belong to no organized party. I'm a Democrat. It's kind of looking that way for the Republicans in Michigan this year.
I'm not sure about that. I think this is a personal more than a party problem. I think you've got a dispute between the lieutenants of the Snyder administration and the governor himself and Bill Schuette and his camp. I don't think it's party-wide. I expect Republicans in general will choose Bill Schuette over Gretchen Whitmer. I don't see a huge defection out of the party. But when it comes to fundraising, I think that's where the issue is here. I think the governor could have been a potent fundraiser for the Republican ticket, but I don't see him doing that for Bill Schuette.
Is any of this going to really matter to the voters in the long run? I mean, is it just a little dust up now and forgotten in a week?
It may raise flags with some voters. I'm sure the Whitmer camp is going to exploit it. Why wouldn't they? So it may matter a little. I don't think it's going to be the driving issue. Rick Snyder's popularity is not that strong in Michigan. Trump loyalists don't like him all that much because he never got behind Trump. So, you know, and the Flint debacle cost him a little broader support with independents and Democrats. So, you know, it's not like he was a huge get-out-the-vote guy for the Republican ticket, but he could have helped with the money.
I want to ask you about one other gubernatorial candidate, and that's Patrick Colbeck. In my county, Patrick Colbeck got more votes than Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly.
What county was that?
Lenawee. I'm just wondering how well he did statewide.
Well, he finished third, but he ran, you know, strong enough. You can't say that he cost Kelly the nomination. I think he took as many votes or more, probably more, from Bill Schuette. But you saw his signs everywhere. I mean, he was really good with the grassroots. He just didn't have enough money, enough financial support, or a broad enough message to carry him over the top. Not getting the Trump endorsement hurt him, helped Schuette.
Ken Tickham and I were talking, if yard signs turn into votes, Patrick Colbeck had that race. And
oh, boy. I think he spent all his money on yard signs.
It could be.
Everybody commented on it, but he did about what you would expect. The surprise for me was that Brian Kelly didn't do better.
So is everybody going to kiss and make up at the convention?
We'll see. They ought to. I mean, but they may not. I think if the governor won't. I doubt the governor will even come to the convention. But if Brian Kelly is going to have a future in the party, I think it's incumbent on him to make amends. And if Bill Schuette recognizes that this is not going to be an easy race for him, it's in his best interest to get all of the Republicans behind him, including Brian Kelly and his supporters.
That is Nolan Finley. He's the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
There's a new $555 million dairy processing plant planned for St. John's, north of Lansing. The Lansing State Journal reported economic development types were calling it one of the largest dairy processing operations in the country. A huge deal, not only for the region, but for the state overall. A new level of ag tech production that's going to enormously impact the entire dairy ecosystem of the whole state. Joining us to give a little insight into whether this facility is everything it's claimed to be is Chris Wolf. He's a professor in the Agricultural, Food, and Resource Economics Department at Michigan State University. Chris, how big of a deal is this dairy processing plant?
Well, this is a really big deal for the state's dairy industry. Michigan's milk production has been growing at a rapid pace for the past couple of decades, but especially for the past few years, and had outgrown the processing capacity, which has resulted in some pretty low farm milk prices, and this type of development is going to help the farm prices get back into alignment with where they ought to be and where the surrounding states are.
Yeah, I've been told that Michigan has had this glut for a while and has exported out of the state. So we're looking at this plant. It's going to be processing 8 million pounds of milk a day, make 300 million pounds of cheese a year. Put that into perspective for us. How much of Michigan's milk production does that amount to?
That's a pretty big percentage of Michigan's milk production if it's completely full and it's all coming from Michigan. You know, that could be as 20% or more of Michigan's milk production if it's operating at capacity. And I assume if you're making that kind of investment, you want it to operate at capacity.
How long do you think it'll be before this plant is up and running and buying milk?
No, that's an excellent question. And I'll tell you what, that's the $64,000 or more question for the state's dairy farmers that have had the lowest milk prices in the country for the last couple of years. And so this is certainly going to give them some hope as we move forward. I hope that they can do it quickly. This development has been in the works for a long time, actually, because there's so many moving parts on the input and the output side of it. If they can break ground, you know, hopefully they can be taking milk in 18 months to 2 years. I think that's their plan.
Explain something to me, because I don't quite understand it. Most commodities have, you know, a market price, the national price. Why would one state like Michigan have depressed milk prices compared to other states?
That's a good question. So we do have national prices for cheese and butter and milk powders like dry whey and things of that nature. And Michigan is competitive in the national and international markets. But the reason that the farmers have been getting lower milk prices And in fact, the lowest milk prices in the country for the past couple of years in Michigan is because of this excess, this glut of milk that you were talking about that doesn't have a home. So the farmers pay the hauling costs for their milk to go from their farm to the plant.
Oh, so if they have to take it to Illinois
to sell it.
They have
to go further, yeah. Or in the extreme case, when there is no home and it ends up being dumped, then they bear the cost of it.
Why do you think this Irish company, which is the lead partner in this dairy processing plant, chose St. John's?
Well, first of all, St. John's being centrally located helps because we have milk produced in the Thumb, we have milk in the Southwest, and we have milk in, say, Maasauke County and up in that area. And then, actually, the St. John's, the Clinton County, Gratiot County area has really been a growth area of milk production. So it's kind of centrally located and near some of the more recent milk production growth. It's also conveniently located as far as close to highways, as far as, you know, getting in and out. And I'm assuming that they looked at things like labor costs and labor availability. And so I'm certain that there was a whole bunch of factors that went into picking that location.
So what are dairy farmers telling you?
Well, I think everybody is cautiously optimistic. It's been, you know, 3 or 4 years of kind of a growing problem that, you know, and everybody's been waiting for kind of the light at the end of the tunnel. And so I think people are happy to hear it, but, you know, cautiously optimistic and hoping to make it to the point where it's going to be beneficial.
That's Chris Wolf. He's a professor in the Agricultural Food and Resource Economics Department at Michigan State University. Hey, thanks for taking the time.
All right, thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk with the author of a new book about Detroit architect Albert Kahn. Among the highlights, how Kahn helped the Soviets defeat the Nazis, and why Henry Ford, despite his anti-Semitism, worked so closely with the German-born Jewish immigrant.
Ford and Kahn seemed to understand one another. They were each uneducated men. Kahn never went beyond elementary school. Henry Ford was disdainful of men with college degrees.
That's in about 10 minutes. And later in the show, we'll recap this week's primary election with our regular Friday commentators. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. At the Library of Congress later this month, 5 teenagers from across the country will be honored as National Student Poets. Among those 5 is Darius Adifat Peckham of Interlochen, and he joins us now. First of all, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So as a National Student Poet, you are to serve as literary ambassador, and for you it will be for the Midwest region. So what specifically does that mean? What will you be doing?
So, you know, I go to school up at Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan. So I'll be working around that area. Different schools can go on the site and request my services, my poet services, I guess. In the larger sense, you know, we'll be traveling around reading our own poems with each other, the 5 student poets. We have a reading in D.C. We have a reading in Newark. I mean, I'm super excited for it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what drives you. Why has poetry become a significant part of your life?
I always grew up around poetry. My mom was a poet. My dad is a poet. My stepmom is a poet. And what I write about, I write about kind of reconnecting with a heritage that I haven't really been able to remember or be in contact with as much as I'd like to. I'm an Iranian-American. My mom passed away when I was 3 years old in a car accident with my brother. You know, my entire life has just been kind of trying to reconnect with that heritage. The Iranian part of that heritage is, for a lot of my life, has felt kind of far away, difficult to reach. You know, and this is what my mom wrote about, was her experiences as an Iranian-American. And that gives me kind of a way to reconnect with her and with my heritage.
Well, let's break those 2 things down just a little bit. As you mentioned, you're Iranian American at a time when the relationship between America and Iran are tense. Does that tension affect you personally or your poetry?
You know, I think that it's important that there are just Iranian people in America who are involved in the arts, who are involved in that kind of empathy and that kind of beauty. So, you know, I try to let my work speak for itself and try not to go too political, but sometimes it's difficult, you know, with the climate as it is. My grandparents are Iranian, so, you know, they have some trouble going back and forth. My grandma was just telling me she went to visit her family in Iran, and then she came back through London Airport, and she said, they asked her where she was going, and she said, "I'm going to America," and they're like, "Why would you want to do that?" You know, and it's just like the tension around the world really is affecting Iranian Americans and Iranians everywhere. So, you know, it's difficult not to get political, but, you know, you try and let your work speak for itself.
You mentioned that you're in a family of poets and that you lost your mother in a car wreck about 14 years ago. You were quite young, 3. How much has her poetry and that loss affected your desire to compose poems?
Absolutely. I grew up around poetry. I read poetry at a very young age. One of the things that made me connect with my mother the most when I was little was just reading her poems. She had a book of poems come out with Coffee House Press in 2000. So, you know, I had that book of poems to go back to and read when I felt like I was, you know, lost in that connection and I wanted to be reconnected. So I would read those poems and gain inspiration from them. Nowadays, I'm just trying to kind of find my own voice and decide what, you know, what's right for me that way.
Well, you said you're trying to find your own voice. What kind of poetry outside of the family draws you?
Yeah, actually, right now, I think the most important poets, at least in America right now, are people of color, people, you know, immigrants. So I'm really drawn to people like Solmaz Sharif. There's an Iranian poet named Sholeh Wolpe, who's just an amazing translator, amazing poet. I got to see her read. It's incredible. And also black poets right now, I'm really drawn to Ross Gay, Marcus Wicker, Rita Dove, and Tracy K. Smith, who I'll get to meet in August, which I'm so incredibly excited for. You know, and I think these marginalized voices are so especially important right now in poetry and in America. So,
you've written some poems. Let's talk about your poetry a little bit about death and war. That's pretty heavy stuff for a 17-year-old. Why do you feel the need to tackle such tough subjects?
I don't know. I guess it's just what I feel drawn to. I also write a lot about music, a lot about just, I'm trying to get back into that. This is what I love about Ross Gay's Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude. That book is all about joy, his path towards it. So I'm trying to write about war, but I think you can't really connect with that joyful feeling without also exploring the depths of sadness, of war and brutality. And so I'm trying to make my way towards that feeling where I can write about that pure joy.
Well, I think we should hear one of your poems. Would you read one of them for us, please?
Yeah, absolutely. This is called Of a Sufi Woman. My mother's sadness, diaphanous, which to me was like the rolled prayer shawl held overhead, one's toe breaking the shallows, stepping where cardinal fire bloomed dark on the wet stones. Give heed to the shots of fire crackling behind her. Hope that the gears don't slick in the river's current.
So why did you want to read that poem? Why did you choose that one for us?
You know, it's a short poem, but I found this picture online after the Sinai Mosque attacks in 2017. Basically, that was militants, gunmen went in and attacked this Sinai Mosque. And it's a Sufi mosque. So, you know, there are all these people there who were praying. And if you don't know much about the Sufi religion, it's this really peaceful sect of the Islamic religion. And my mother was really, really interested in Sufism. There are amazing Sufi poets, Hafez. Rumi was very drawn to that religion. It's a very peaceful, very intellectual, thoughtful religion. And they were attacked, and I found this picture of this woman walking out of the mosque, you know, while it's going up in flames behind her. And she's walking out, and she's holding this prayer shawl over her head while stepping through a river current. And I just saw so much, you know, sadness, so much hope also instilled in the picture, that she, you know, she brought that prayer shawl with her, that it was important enough in that moment for her to say, you know, I'll need this even through this hardship. So I was drawn towards that and tried to kind of do a brushstroke of what I saw there.
Your mom has a legacy of poetry, and you, I assume, read it occasionally. How does that feel today, now that you're a recognized poet yourself?
You know, it feels it feels good. A lot of people telling me that I'm, you know, living through her, that I'm, you know, kind of continuing her legacy. And I'm, you know, I'm trying to find my own start. But I also want people to know that, you know, her voice has always been so inspiring to me throughout my childhood, throughout my teenage years, you know, and just having this, you know, this beautiful voice to fall back on, this calm, this empathetic and beautiful voice is just, you know, it's an incredible asset to me. And, you know, I think, yeah, I just, you know, I hope if she were here that she'd be, you know, she'd be happy with what I'm doing. And that's kind of how I feel about it. But,
Darius, I've got one more question, and it gets to the soul of everything, I think. Do you write for an audience, or do you write whatever comes out of your heart?
You know, I think that it's important to recognize who your audience may be as a poet. I think it's important to write something that you think will help not only yourself, but, you know, everyone who needs it. Ultimately, you know, there's not a large audience for poetry, and it's larger than you think, but it's not like, you know, fiction or novels, that kind of stuff. But really, the people who are picking up your poems are people that really, you know, need it, really feel like they are connected to that voice. And so I think I'm drawn towards my audience, but I think I try to write from the heart, you know, just so that I can write the truest, you know, most real thing that that I can for that audience.
Darius Adifat Peckham is a senior at Interlochen Arts Academy. He's been named a National Student Poet for 2018, representing the Midwest. It's been an honor talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Detroit skyline, and the University of Michigan for that matter, would not be the same if it weren't for one of Detroit's more famous architects. Albert Kahn left his mark on Michigan, and he also left his mark on the Soviet Union. We'll explain that just a little more, just a little bit. But first, let me introduce our guest. Michael Hodges covers fine arts for the Detroit News. He's also the author of a new book, Building the Modern World, Albert Kahn in Detroit. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So first, to give everybody an idea of what we're talking about, tick through a list of Kahn buildings in Detroit.
Kahn built a large share of what we consider old Detroit. So it's the Fisher Building. It's the General Motors Building. It's the Detroit Athletic Club, both newspaper buildings, and also the old Detroit Times building, which has been torn down.
How about on the University of Michigan campus?
Well over half of what we consider the old part of the university, Hill Auditorium, Natural Sciences, the Graduate Library, the Engineering Building with the Arch, Clements Library.
So that's a lot. How did this impoverished German Jewish immigrant kid end up as a revolutionary architect of manufacturing plants, too, we should mention, and buildings on a grand scale like you just described?
Kahn was lucky when he arrived in the United States from Luxembourg, actually, at age 12. His family was dirt poor, but his mother managed to get him a job in an architect's office, unpaid.
At age 12.
At 13, yeah, right. Unpaid for the first year. He eventually landed in the distinguished architecture firm of Mason and Rice when he was 13 or 14.
It was a rocky way of getting there, right? Though he's had a couple of stumbles in his architecture career, right?
Yeah, first he was working for the John L. Scott Company. Scott built the old Wayne County Courthouse near Campus Martius. And Kahn had a job before he went to the architecture office every morning rubbing down two horses. So basically, this little unwashed German would show up reeking of the stable, and the Scott people eventually heaved him out with insults. I have often thought that several years later, they probably realized they made an incredible mistake.
I'll bet. Kahn did a lot of important work for Henry Ford, early work for Henry Ford. Well, let's talk about first what he did for him, because it's significant and changed things for a lot of the way we build factories.
Kahn starts working for Henry Ford about 1908, working on the Highland Park plant. Henry Ford noticed Kahn because he had built the famous building number 10 at the Packard motor car plant on Detroit's east side. Kahn builds pretty much everything at Highland Park. But the most important building is the building that got torn down, which was the original Automotive Assembly Building, which had so much glass in it that it was immediately nicknamed the Crystal Palace by Detroiters.
Now, Ford was a virulent anti-Semite, and here we've got a guy who's comes from a Jewish family. How did they get along?
Yeah, comes from a Jewish family, and his father was a rabbi. Ford and Kahn seemed to understand one another. They were each uneducated men. Kahn never went beyond elementary school. Henry Ford was disdainful of men with college degrees. And in Kahn, he seems to have found somebody who spoke the same pragmatic language that Henry Ford liked. They got along, as far as I can tell, quite well. Kahn ends up doing almost everything for Ford around the country, you know, forever, basically, up through the 30s.
He basically tolerated that anti-Semitism because it was very public. He used to put out a paper about his views on the Jewish world.
Yes. Ford's anti-Semitism doesn't become public, as I understand it, until about 1915. That is, it doesn't get radiated out to the public when he blames World War I on Jewish financiers. But it explodes into the public view in 1920 with the anti-Semitic series in Ford's newspaper, the weekly Dearborn Independent, which was called The International Jew, The World's Problem.
Albert Kahn designed hundreds of factories for the Soviet Union. How did he get tapped for that?
The Soviets sent a delegation in the mid to late 20s to basically scope out who was the best industrial architect in America that they could import. And largely because of the Ford factories, they pick Albert Kahn. He gets hired as the chief consulting architect for the Kremlin's first five-year plan and has an office in Moscow with 25 men from Detroit from 1929 to 31. In those years, he builds the lion's share, well over half, of the industrial capacity that would end up enabling the Soviets to defeat the Nazis in World War II.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. How significant was that? I mean, why do you say that?
The Kahn firm built over 500 factories in the 2.5 years that they're in the Soviet Union. They design and oversee the construction of them all across, both in the Asian and European halves of the country. Now, Kahn was building tractor plants and cement plants and electrical plants and whatnot, but all of those end up being converted, just like his factories in the United States, to war production in the late 30s.
And prior to that moment, the Soviet Union was basically agricultural and in the 19th century still, or farther back.
Russia was the most profoundly backward country in Europe. So really what the Soviets were trying to do was sort of this blitzkrieg industrialization overnight.
Let's go back to the Detroit. You tell the story about a backlash against the Diego Rivera murals at the Detroit Institute of Arts and how Albert Kahn played a role in saving them. Now, it's hard to understand because those are beloved murals today, right? Who didn't like them at the time?
The bourgeoisie, people with money who were appalled that their restful garden court at the DIA had been disfigured with pictures of grimy factories.
And by a socialist on top of that.
And by a guy who's trying to get back in the good graces of the Mexican Communist Party.
What was Kahn's role in saving those murals?
Kahn was on the Arts Commission that governed the DIA for the city when it was owned by the city, along with Edsel Ford, who was a very good friend of Kahn's. In some respects, Kahn was a mentor to the younger Edsel Ford. There was an controversy that erupted when the murals were first unveiled. A large group of conservative religious figures attacked one of the panels, the vaccination panels, as being blasphemous and anti-Christian. The day after the unveiling, Kahn gave an interview to my newspaper, the Detroit News, which interestingly we buried in the middle of the front section. But he basically said that anyone who didn't recognize that Mr. Rivera had put Detroit on the world artistic map was adult. He could be a little peppery when he was confronted with what he regarded as patent stupidity.
The Fisher Building in Detroit is a favorite of Instagram photographers and considered a real gem of Art Deco. But you write the building was never fully realized. What do you mean by that?
The Fisher Building was initially supposed to be this humongous project with three towers. The tower that we have was supposed to be the easternmost. It's not even the center tower. On the western edge, a block and a half or two blocks away, was going to be an identical tower to the Fisher Building. And in between was going to be a 50 or 60 story tower. that the two would bookend.
Wow. Okay.
But the Depression got in the way. So the Fisher brothers end up just building the Fisher Building and then the new center building behind it, which is now called the Albert Kahn Building.
You've got a lot of great archival photos in the book, really like those. And I have to tell you, some pretty good contemporary shots that you took. What kind of camera are you using?
I'm using a Canon full-frame camera. The only reason I do books is so I can take the pictures and pretend I'm an architectural photographer.
So this was basically you being a photo enthusiast. You got this past the publishers, though. That's pretty good. I'd say you did all right.
I was lucky. I'd done a book in 2012 on old Michigan train stations that Wayne State University Press published. So when I came back to them with Albert Kahn, they were already kind of primed and had decided I was okay.
You passed the bar.
I passed the bar.
You know, as a photography enthusiast, I was really impressed. I thought they were pretty good shots.
So. Thank you very much.
The book is Building the Modern World, Albert Kahn in Detroit. The author is Michael Hodges. Thanks for putting this book together for us.
Thank you.
Still to come, White Right Meeting the Enemy is a new documentary about white nationalists on Netflix.
Anytime you're in an area where the economy is suffering, it's somewhere that our message resonates with the people. So Detroit is an excellent city for us to be in.
We'll talk with the filmmaker next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. 1 year after the violent and ultimately deadly Unite the Right white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, another one is planned, this time in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk with someone who was at the Charlottesville rally and walked with the white nationalists. Her name is Dia Kahn. She was embedded with the National Socialist Movement, neo-Nazis. She was filming a documentary that is now available on Netflix. Its title is White Right, Meeting the Enemy. Dia Kahn joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So because of the subject matter of the film, it's about race, about religion, ethnicity, and all of those play into it. Would you please describe yourself in those aspects?
Well, so I am a woman of color. My family is Muslim. My father is from Pakistan. My mother is from Afghanistan. So I am the daughter of immigrants. But I myself was actually born and raised in Norway.
Why in the world would you want to spend so much time with neo-Nazis and white nationalists?
Racism is an issue that we have all lived with for a very long time. And I, at least when I was growing up, I was always told, look, you just need to give this time and eventually this problem will disappear. And the reality is that it's not going anywhere. And I've tried everything. I've participated in anti-fascist, anti-racist protests. I've done a lot of activism and a lot of work around this topic. And I just finally got to a point where I realized I needed to try something different. And I was tired of being afraid of people like this. And I was tired of only being angry at them. And I got to a place where I realized I needed to understand them. I needed to sit down and see if it's possible for us to have a conversation with each other and for me to retain my humanity in the process and also not deny them theirs.
Now, you talked to several people in the white nationalist movement, including a man, a Michigan man in the National Socialist Movement named Jeff Scoop. Let me play that clip.
Anytime you're in an area where the economy is suffering, it's somewhere that our message resonates with the people. So Detroit is an excellent city for us to be in.
Who is Scoop and why did you talk to him?
Well, Jeff Scoop is the leader of the National Socialist Movement in America, the NSM, and that is the largest neo-Nazi group across the United States. And so the reason I wanted to talk to him is because of the size of his organization and also the fact that he is the leader of it. Initially, he declined to speak to me, as you would imagine most of these groups would. But eventually, he gave in and he said, look, I'll give you 1 hour. That's all you have. And we did get together in a motel in Detroit. And I remember feeling quite nervous before he arrived, because it suddenly dawned on me that this is actually going to happen. I'm actually going to get to meet and sit with a neo-Nazi. And suddenly, you know, everything, all the sort of worst scenarios start running through your mind. You know, what if they're armed? What if he comes with several people? You know, what if? And he did show up. He came alone, as promised. And he sat down, and we finished our first hour that he had promised. And after that, a subsequent 4 hours, and we just continued talking. And at the end of those 5 hours, he basically said, look, in a few weeks, we're going to this rally in Charlottesville, and you're welcome to join us if you would like to do that.
So you went with him. You took your video camera to Charlottesville last year. You were in the street with the National Socialist Movement members. What was going through your mind at the time?
I was extremely nervous because I have been to rallies like this in the past, but I've always been on the other side. I've always been in the counter-protests. So to march in to a rally like this with neo-Nazis and other white supremacists, you know, Klan members and all kinds of other groups, was surreal. It was very frightening for me. And the reason for that is, even though Jeff Scoop was okay with me and he promised me that I would be safe, the men around him and all the other various groups that we marched in with obviously were not okay with a woman of color walking in with them. So, you know, the looks and the comments and the aggressive posturing that a lot of them had towards me was nerve-wracking. And then also the tension was constantly escalating between the white supremacists and also the counter-protesters. So I knew that violence or some sort of clashes were imminent. It was in the air from the minute we stepped outside into Charlottesville.
In some of your interviews, and you did quite a few of them, you shared some of the hate emails you've gotten because of your activism in the past and because of a BBC interview of you. Those emails were vile. Most of it we couldn't repeat on the radio, but you read it to some of these people you interviewed. How did they react?
You know, it surprised me quite a bit, because the types of threats that I've gotten is from people like the men that I interviewed. So the language within these emails and the content and the violence that these messages were saying that was going to be committed against me is nothing that is new for any of these guys. So I found it really interesting that once I actually sat down and read it to their face, they all, without fail, were extremely uncomfortable and wanted me to stop, almost. And I remember asking, actually, Jeff, you know, it's surely this is not the first time that you're hearing this language. Surely this is not the first time you're hearing any of these types of descriptions of someone who looks like me. And he said, no, it's not the first time. And I said, so what's the problem? And he just couldn't answer. He just looked really uncomfortable. And it was really clear that words matter. And once you see the impact of your words on someone, I think it's difficult for some people to stand by hateful words like that and violent words like that. And Jeff Scoop, certainly, to my surprise, did find it very uncomfortable.
In the end, some of these white nationalists, most of whom never met a Muslim before, said they felt that you were a friend. And at the end of the documentary, one of those leaders of the National Socialist Movement called you. What did he want?
So he was a long-standing member of the National Socialist Movement. He used to be their PR director and had served in various other capacities within the group over the years. He called me and he said, look, I have decided to leave the entire movement because I do not believe in what it stands for anymore. I don't believe in violence, and I don't believe in the idea that we have to remain separate. We're going to have to sit down with people that we disagree with and people who are different from us and see if it's possible to find a way forward together. I was actually in the middle of the edit. I'd already finished filming. I was in the middle of the edit, and I get this call from Brian Culpepper, is his name. And I was absolutely astonished. I was so moved, and I still feel really moved even thinking about it. This is something I never would have expected. This is something I never planned on, never thought would be possible when I started making this film. But it just goes to show that contact with people who are different from you is absolutely necessary. And it's just as necessary for people like us as it is for white nationalists, for example. You know, I think we're all finding ourselves stuck in echo chambers. And, you know, I keep coming back to, we have to recognize each other's humanity and we have to find a way to make this work. We don't have the choice of saying, we're not going to engage, because what's the alternative of not engaging? It's violence. And surely that's an unacceptable outcome. Only banning them and only condemning them isn't going to make it go away.
The film is White Right, Meeting the Enemy. A good portion of the film was shot in Michigan. You can find it on Netflix. Diya Khan is the documentarian. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk to our Friday political commentators about this week's primary elections. Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. He joins us via Skype. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. So we have Schuette Whitmer race for governor, Estabanel James race for U.S. Senate, the congressional races, the legislative races. Any surprises, Ken?
No, I think from a big picture standpoint, I'm not surprised. The Schuette versus Whitmer matchup has been predicted for over a year here. I think the polling was pretty accurate. I think turnout presents a good fall for the Democrats. It's consistent with results from around the country for several months. The Trump endorsement matters in a Republican primary. Money isn't the only thing. Otherwise, Sharif Anadar would be the Democratic nominee for governor. And yard signs aren't the only thing. Otherwise, Patrick Colbeck would be the Republican nominee for governor. But from my standpoint, big picture, no, there were no surprises.
Vicki, any surprises for you?
I agree with Ken. There were very few surprises mentioned for governor and on down. But the strength of women candidates was really surprising. Where there was a woman on the ballot, she tended to win if she were running against men. And that was borne out real clearly in one of the biggest upsets in Michigan, which was the Senate 5 district, where an unknown woman who had filed a waiver to spend no more than $1,000 beat an incumbent male, which was very surprising.
That was in the Dearborn area.
Yeah, so Senator Dave Kinesic looks like he lost his primary.
So the next step for Democrat Gretchen Whitmer and Republican Bill Schuette is to choose a running mate. What kind of person does each one need to make the ticket stronger, Ken?
Well, I think these gubernatorial nominees always try to assess their ticket and where they need to balance it. So on the Republican side, you know, you probably look toward a woman candidate from Southeast Michigan, if you can do that. And you know, on the Democratic side, I think there's been a lot of speculation that, you know, you probably need an African-American male from Detroit, because the Democrats look like they're poised to have, you know, 3 women, governor, attorney general, secretary of state. I do think at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter much. I mean, this is a Schuette Whitmer race, and it's going to be decided based on that, not who the lieutenant governor candidates are.
Yeah, we should note Bill Schuette's hinted that he will choose a woman for a running mate. Vicki, what kind of person do you think they need to make the ticket stronger?
I hope they recognize they need somebody competent and somebody who is able to take over should some horrible fate befall the governor. On the Democratic side, Ken's right. You want to balance out the ticket, both in terms of different kinds of people that are on the ticket, as well as geographic balance. And I think that that's really important. And some of the names that have been mentioned for Gretchen Whitmer's running mate certainly are African-American men, but they're also extremely competent, and I'm very excited about the potential choices she has available to her.
So we had more than 2 million voters, 2.1 million voters turning up for the polls for the primary election, which is up substantially from a midterm primary election. What does that tell us?
Well, there's a lot of interest in this election. In the case of the governor's race, it's an open seat. And I think the Trump factor is playing into this and that Democratic turnout. I think the pattern of the turnout benefits Democrats, and that's true around the country and has been true for better part of a year. So there's a lot of interest, and a lot of it, I think, is driven by, on the Republican side, you know, kind of support for Trump, but on the Democratic side, you know, the opposite. And in the turnout pattern, I think, is an advantage to them going into the fall campaign.
Vicki?
The turnout across the state was way up, which is an encouraging sign based on the fact that more Democratic ballots were cast than Republican. In Oakland County alone, we topped 34% in terms of voter turnout for the primary, which probably accounts for some of the ballot shortages that were mentioned throughout Oakland County. The surprising thing here, to me, was the strength of anger of independents who came out to vote in Oakland County, as well as the strength of the Democratic voters to really have their say this time. So I think that that's going to continue. We knew that absentee ballots were up significantly across Oakland County, and that portended well because this county had voted heavily for Hillary Clinton. And I think that according to the Detroit News article this morning, there was a strength of voters and strength in turnout in areas where Hillary Clinton had won the presidential race in counties across Michigan. So that was, while it was a surprise of the strength of the turnout, what it really showed us was that independents in suburban areas are very, very angry with the direction of the Republican Party, and they are turning out to vote in Democratic primaries and will continue to do so in the general election, I predict.
You know, statewide, more than 100,000 more voters chose a Democratic ballot than a Republican ballot. Does that tell us anything about what to expect in the general election, or is it just apples and oranges?
Well, I think it does. I wouldn't look at just the kind of the Michigan factoid in and of itself. It's consistent with what's been happening in other states around the country for several months that have led political pundits to speculate about a blue wave. So Republicans are going to try to put a good face on this turnout and say, well, our turnout's high and our voters are energized too. But I just think if you take an independent look at all of this, that this turnout pattern in Michigan and around the country, it's advantage Democrats going into the fall election. I don't see how else you could interpret this.
I think Ken's right. While you can't really draw a direct correlation between the number of turnout voters in a primary to a general election, you can certainly take a look at the evidence that will support a strong Democratic voting wave, not only in Michigan, but across the country. And we did see this starting to build last year in local elections in the state of Michigan and in primary elections and special elections across the country. So I think the Democrats are particularly energized and excited to vote this year. And I think that the large independent base across the country is very frustrated with what is happening in Washington and in their state legislatures, and will be turning out to probably cast a Democratic Party vote.
Well, and one thing to point out is on Tuesday when we had our primary here, there was a special election in Ohio for a vacant congressional seat. The Republican advantage on that in that seat is 12 to 15 points historically, and I don't think they still know who won. So, again, it's portending this sort of blue wave that has been speculated about.
Yeah, and I don't think you can discount the ballot proposals and the strength they'll have in drawing out more progressive voters to the polls this November. The anti-gerrymandering bill, Voters Not Politicians, will be on the ballot, as well as recreational marijuana and paid sick leave. And I think that that's going to further energize progressives and people who really think that fairness is the issue, and they will come out and vote for those ballot proposals.
That is Vicki Barnett. She's a former Democratic legislator. We also heard from Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. Hey, you two, enjoy the general election campaigns.
Thank you. We will.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. who insists everything we do for Stateside is all for him. You keep thinking that, pal. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, Sarah Lisa and Leeson, and Gabby Horton. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.